Okay, great, thanks. So this talk will be a little different in the sense, first of all, it's gonna be very short. Second of all, I don't have a theory I wanna push. I don't have a model for a globular cluster formation at high redshift. All we've been studying is the formation of the very first objects in these cold dark matter scenarios. And what we find, it's not globular clusters. So, you know, you might have not been surprised, whatever, but we can show directly why it's not globular clusters. And so there's a lot of issues that now come up for these very first objects. They have that mass, scale of around 10 to the 6 solar masses that we're all interested in this room. And so many of the issues that we have to worry about in figuring out sort of the formation of these first objects and their subsequent evolution are very much the same as what you worry about. So why this talk, why this speaker? That's what I was trying to address. At least sort of the late 60s, people were arguing about that perhaps the things that looked to be older than the universe, you know, were at least the first things that formed. And so it was one of the motivations why we really went into studying this. So the expectations of that CDM scenario Kathy already mentioned is you have a spectrum of density fluctuations in the early universe, and here just shown as excess mass at a given mass scale. For the dark matter, that continues to almost arbitrary small scales. But actually, the first object, gravitational bound object that would form in a CDM model, is at the free streaming scale, and that, you know, can be depends very much on the underlying dark matter particle physics, but nevertheless, it could be a small sort of Himalaya size scale, mass scales, the tiny things. However, their potential well is so shallow that will not be able to get any gas into them. So basically, you don't form anything interesting. You just form a whole bunch of dark matter balls, really boring guys. And that's sort of shown here with the blue curve, is that the gas has a cutoff in the length scale that it has density perturbations on. The other key idea is that sort of the temperature of the intergalactic medium as a function of redshift sort of drops as you get to lower and lower redshift. Here would be, like that would be the CMB temperature. You notice the gas actually drops faster after redshift of about 130. It's just the heating time becomes longer than the expansion time scale. And so you get to very low temperatures, perhaps only 10 Kelvin or so in the IGM, and that's why this gas has very little pressure and can fall into small potential wells that's provided by the dark matter fluctuations that you had. And so the nice thing also is that you have a few free electrons left over from recombination, because recombination is just not complete simply because of the effect. As your protons, electrons get further apart, the mean distances, you know, the recombination time gets longer. And at some point, it becomes longer than the expansion time. You get a freeze out of free electrons. And those guys we use then to make molecular hydrogen via this negative hydrogen ion. And at higher densities, use three-body reactions. Sorry. And so that's the coolant, and that gets you all going. And so, but this whole scenario has been around a long time. You know, people always have argued about you need masses higher than the Cheyne scale, and then molecular hydrogen formation to cool the gas to make something interesting. What's shown here is a movie from a recent simulation we've done, which just shows contours of density. So all these different colors are contours at different densities. It's about a kiloparsec across and spans redshift from 100. We're all already down to 25 or so. You see all these small objects continuously merging. That's all the gas density. And just notice all the turbulence in the flow. It's all driven by gravity alone. Now we're just zooming towards it. That was now the first million solar mass object that formed in that simulation. We'll eventually gonna zoom in. And the different rendering here, again, all the contours are at different densities. So the blue is a lower density, green slightly higher, red, yellow. Again, here is that object, has about 10 to the 6 solar masses, total 10 to the 5 in gas mass. From here to here is about 200 parsec scale. Notice the dark matter halos, they're really radii, are much larger than the globular cluster ones. So when you talk about, you know, whether globular clusters can have dark matter halos around them or not, you have to be very specific about how concentrated they are, because, you know, that's all you could be telling from tidal tails. Now, but the whole idea was, well, you know, within this object, you get a dense molecular cloud forming at the center. This molecular cloud only has 10 to the minus 3 molecule fraction. So it's an analog to molecular cloud in the sense that it's a cold region. This is cooled to about 100, 200 Kelvin by H2 cooling. And the question was, what's going to happen to it? Is it going to fragment into lots of little stars, or is it just going to all go down a drain, make a supermassive black hole? And you find, I mean, tens of papers in the literature that argue exactly from the same initial conditions for very different outcomes. And so it's really the first time we can probe that with these type of simulations. So now I just zoomed in that little, oops, just don't get used to this guy. Just zoomed in the central region that hosted the molecular cloud, just this blue spot here. And look at that, that's sort of this 10 parsec scale, what this looks like. In these first objects, you see there's rounder contours in the density. And that has nothing to do with numerical resolution or anything, it's a physical effect. It has to do with H2 cooling becoming independent of density above you go when you go above the critical density. So all of a sudden, your collapse happens not on the dynamical time, but on the cooling time, which is slightly longer than the dynamical time. So your cloud has time to wobble, basically trying to adjust its pressure. And as a consequence, you have relatively smooth isocontours. Now here, just in a movie representation, as we fly in into this object, there's about 1,000 solar masses in here. As we're going down and further, you go into the dense core of the molecular cloud, you see much rounder structures appearing. Pressure becomes important here. Pure effect of having no dust around. As you go in even deeper, we find a protostar that in this case has only one solar mass in mass, pure hydrogen helium, and you see this flattened structure around it, like an accretion disk forming. You can tell rotation stars become important. However, this object is still accreting at about 10 to the minus 2 solar masses a year at this time. And we argue it's very hard for this protostar to act back on this very rapid infall, and that you have to form a massive star. There's really no escape. That's where it comes from. So when you have a massive star, it's going to produce an H2 region, which we just simulated here, very sort of toy calculation, just in 1D. Let me just point out the density. I put in the density profile that we found from a three-dimensional calculation, switch on a star, you know, they're quite luminous. If you put in 120 solar mass, there's 10 to the 50, actually, photons per second. You see sort of as time goes on, the density goes down around the star. And after 3 million years, the H2 region, you know, is already almost out at the virial radius of the object that the star formed. At this point, the material is moving at almost 30 kilometers a second in an object that has an escape velocity of 3 kilometers a second. So just the radiative feedback, just having switching on the star will destroy this entire host halo, this little microgalaxy I showed you there. The next thing, of course, that happens is if you do have a massive star, it just goes supernova. And so here, again, that was sort of the scale of a couple of hundred parsecs across. And all I did is just put in 10 to the 51 ergs at a very small scale where the star formed without even worrying about the H2 region. So the, you know, the worst case scenario of the star has to blow out the entire thing, and it can easily do, because you have 10 to the 6 solar mass object, but with a 10 times larger radius than your typical globular cluster. So the binding energy is very low. And even efficient cooling didn't do it, so you just get all the metals out. So a few things we learned is, like these first you form the stars, they are massive, they form in isolation. They get all the UV radiation out. And presumably all the metals that they form will get into the intergalactic medium. So any second-generation structure, like the ones Kathy was talking about, had this as initial conditions. There are at least a few of these that go into any dwarf galaxy. And if you think about the Milky Way, there were actually probably about 100,000 regions, similar to the one I've just been focusing on. Actually, so if you zoom out to a larger scale, and you do this with different types of numerical codes and different resolutions, different cosmologies, but you just see on this scale of about 600 co-moving kiloparsec, which means here at redshift 20 is just 30 kiloparsecs across. You have many of these, you know, little objects. All of these yellow ones would be forming these first stars there. Of course, we haven't observed any of that, and this is just trying to really make up initio predictions what's going to come out. Just perhaps an answer to Kathy's question, if you do have enough resolution, which the calculation I showed has a million particles in the virial radius for this object. With perhaps not even the best code to do this, but we see in our microgalaxy of 10 to the 6 solar masses, we have all this substructure still preserved. And I think this argument with sort of the power law stuff actually does not enter at all in any of this destruction of the halos. It's a pure numerical effect if you lose them. And you see here there's even more stunning calculations by Springle et al. That's focusing, of course, on a cluster scale. But what is remarkable is the substructure of this dark matter. It really, you have it on all scales. You know, we have halos here that have like 100 solar masses in that thing. And so if you think about what these models predict also for the structure of the Milky Way halo, you should think also of tiny little clumps like that. Not, you know, and even much further down, perhaps to the free streaming scale. Which is something we cannot simulate yet. And so, but the interesting thing I find too is that any of these scenarios we have, this is hard to see, that's just the distribution of the halo globular clusters in the Milky Way. There's like a little sort of texture map that shows the galaxy for reference. It's just two different views. It's sort of edge on, face on. We know all these orbits and they're strange. You know, all these globular clusters are quite far. And if we want to make cosmological models, I think, you know, that is one of the things we should focus on. Can our theory give us decent orbits? And I think most of the ones proposed in the literature will fail miserably. And that is because two effects of dynamical friction and that you form these small objects at very high redshift, they will tend to end up in the bulge of our galaxy. And people have done this, traced that through the M-body simulations, through where will the things end up that formed first. And they typically end up in the bulges because that is where the bulge region is where you had a high initial density to start out with. So the very first object had a head start right there at the high density, and you end up getting them in the center. And that, of course, would not be so great for us. And so I really rushed through that to get the fit. Well, yeah, there we go. So really don't have much to offer for you in terms of, you know, that one theory of, you know, globular cluster formation explaining everything. But I do want to share this excitement with this type of calculations that I didn't even explain, just, you know, show it is, I think within the next few years, we will be able to really simulate many of these theories that right now we only wave our hands about. We'll be simulate them directly and accurately, really resolve all the mass gains that we need. What I showed you, we covered 10 to the 12 orders of magnitude in length and time scale. If you translate that to mass scales, it's a lot. We can really form, you know, molecular clouds, the cores, and the stars within them. And so, you know, we're going to get there. And so for the first stars, we learned quite a whole bit. But what we also realize is that this feedback will be very crucial. And I'm still very curious of how you can achieve high star formation efficiency. We made one star of 100 solar masses out of 10 to the 5 solar masses of gas. That's not the kind of efficiency, of course, you want for globular clusters. And so I think that will be very interesting to find out. And I'm disappointed sometimes in some of the globular cluster formation models that it's not very addressed why you have such a high star formation. I mean, not all of these models, it's just some of them don't even tell you that. And then, you know, the shameless plug is National Geographic in February. He's going to do that. Not that I make money from that, but still. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about fragmentation in your initial simulations with no metals? It looked as if there wasn't enough cooling to get any fragmentation.
It's a bunch of aspects. First of all, we form one object in the center of the halo. And what happens is your dark matter dominated for a very large part of it. So the virial temperature of the object is only 1,000 Kelvin, and you can cool to about 200 Kelvin. So actually the size of the molecular cloud, if you think of just cooling isobarically, is actually not very, very small compared to the host system. So what you end up with, as soon as you start cooling, everything that loses the pressure now starts moving towards the center of the dark potential. It doesn't even know, you know, that's what dominates. So it's almost like a cooling flow. You pile up things in the center. Now there's this other effect of H2 cooling that the cooling time becomes independent of density at high densities. And that's all of a sudden pressure effects matter. And that's very early. That's at densities of 10 to the 4 parts per cubic centimeter. And so you smooth out any density homogeneities you might have just by pressure waves. The thing just wobbles, cools down smaller. So at that point, you're in a condition where you have a very hard time trying to fragment that stuff. So there's other mechanisms now that we also included at higher densities, which then had a hard time breaking this up because they started out so smoothly.
But I mean, if you don't have dark, if you had no dark matter there, just be sure I'm understanding it. If you had no dark matter,
yeah,
and you were collapsing with a cooling time much longer than your free fall time, then your Gein's mass would not be decreasing. You wouldn't expect fragmentation.
Right.
Saying even though you have cooling, the role of the dark matter, I mean, there's no dark matter in that old argument.
No, there isn't. It's just in the very sort of first setup that you don't make multiple molecular clouds in this object. That's where dark matter matters. But once this molecular cloud forms, you're actually self-gravitating in the gas and dark matter is irrelevant.
You know, and for someone who's not an expert on this, seeing you make stars and have supernovae and all of that, I mean, this is hard enough to try to simulate in the present day. People may or may not have done a lot of it successfully. Now, of course, you have this wonderful simplification of low metallicity, but just coming to it from the outside and trying to understand, it's very puzzling, you know, whether or not one can actually trust some of the details. For example, the supernova is a very important part of it.
Yeah, that's a total toy calculation, actually, but that's why I make this point.
Right. So in terms of getting the metals out, I mean, that's a key point,
right,
but it may or may not actually happen as simple model shows. So I guess what I'm asking you is how robust are the results that come out of it, for example, getting the metals out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, winds are obviously very different in this epoch, in the simulation you're looking at. So is it conceivable that, in fact, the metals don't get out?
Actually not. The only way to not let the metals out is by making a black hole directly, which, you know, we're not excluding right now. If you go up to a 300 solar mass star, you might just collapse directly into a black hole and you wouldn't make any metals. Of course, it's not attractive because we're around and Earth is around. There's metals. Something had to get it started. But nevertheless, I mean, that's an option we discussed. For the supernova, we do. It's really a pure energy argument alone that would have told you that. And, you know, all I have is to show a little movie to go with it, but it's a complete toy calculation. But the point I wanted to make is that the H2 region alone is sufficient to drive out all the gas of this object. These are very feeble things. They have virial temperatures of 1,000 Kelvin. You just heat the gas a little bit, it starts running out. So so you just know that gas will be gone.
So if you instead of a supernova, you had a black hole formation, you still think that just
oh yeah, the gas would all be gone. It's just no metals would be out there because they would be in the black hole.
But isn't that
so in the paper that we published, we were very conservative of what we think the mass range of these first stars is, and we say from 30 to 300 solar masses based on these arguments. And so if you go up to this top mass, and that would mean there's no metals that get out. And that, but the statement relies on stellar evolution models that also are not as good as one might think. Right? They don't do rotation and mixing, whatever. So,
so if you extrapolate your results on the dark matter substructure survival to globular clusters, is that going to be a problem for the Moore argument? I mean, Moore was ruling out sort of comparable mass to the visible cluster within a comparable radius, whereas, of course, we know that globular clusters have, you know, have a much higher phase space density than the dark matter. So are these surviving halos actually going to be a problem to the dynamics of globular clusters or not?
My feeling is I haven't done this in detail, but, you know, I have an envelope. And so my feeling is it's actually no problem. Globular clusters are just so compact
compared
to anything of what we've been looking at.
Yeah. Perhaps the other thing to mention on that is obviously the feedback is going to be much more punishing in your simulations than later, I mean, than in the sort of second generation. I mean, your characteristic masses of the things that you're forming are very high, whereas we know from the kind of pressures that we get in globular clusters, well, we know from direct observation that the characteristic mass is less than a solar mass. So it's not going to be as punishing as forming a 100 solar mass object. but just as a matter of interest, what's the maximum mass that you managed to form? It sounds as though the ionization is the main feedback mechanism for controlling the stellar
right,
mass.
Right.
How high can you get?
My personal feeling now is that I most likely will end up with something around 100 solar masses. But there's different groups in the world that disagree about that, and that's sort of one of the things the next few years we'll be trying to do up in issue. Right now it's really all very hand wavy, sort of not even 1D calculations. It's about, sort of single zone calculation, what the radiation pressure might be, things you use from stellar evolution, I think.
Oh, you weren't putting in the ionizing radiation in 3D there?
Oh yeah.
You were?
Oh yeah. I spent 3 years on working on 3D transfer to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, on similar lines, you asked how can a globular cluster form at higher efficiency, but I can tell from your 3 kilometers per second in a million solar masses, you have a very low pressure, and pressure is the key. Globular clusters have stellar dispersions of 10 to 15 kilometers per second, and so if you increase the pressure by a factor of 1,000, your H2 region will not break up.
I totally agree. Exactly. Here the key though is about the fragmentation bit too, and I think pressure of course is a very big role, and I'm just going to be very curious to see how the actual fragmentation happens, because here we always have a situation where one star wins, one thing always wins and runs away. I wonder, it will be beautiful to see that how that actually works in a cluster directly.
So how feasible is it? Because the key is going to be you have to lose your simplifying assumption of zero metals, right?
Yes.
And it changes the cooling completely and makes it a lot harder to calculate. So do you think you can do that in 5 years or something? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Actually, the cooling, it's not as complicated as one might think. Because, in fact, if you trust the literature on this, it's mostly about grains at the end. And basically, so it's not well known to start out with. So it's not that complicated, because all you can do is use the simple models people have done. And so so the cooling is not the big issue. I just worry about all these feedback mechanisms doing that right.
And because different structures are now going off at different times in the same
Exactly,
flow.
And it's that. And also what you have with metal-enriched stars, massive stars drive winds very quickly. Here, I don't even have to worry about the wind. I only worry about the UV luminosity. And so I don't, and that's much easier to treat.
Well, obviously.